Nick Hornby is our studio guest star this morning. We've got Louis Armstrong and Katie Tunstall coming up in our inheritance tracks. And all of you who've puzzled at the Schwartz-Christoffel mathematical equation for the last 140 years are going to rejoice at the next interview that we're going to do. How is your maths, Nick?
Very, very weak.
I note that in Slam, your latest novel out now, you do occasionally quote maths as being the kind of dry and dusty subject that Sam isn't terribly good at. I mean, it's quite easy to point at maths and go, boring, dull.
It's easy, and that's why I do it.
Oh, yes. You're going to have your mind changed.
I'm the sort of kid that used to feel panic welling up during maths and physics lessons. I wanted to cry.
Right. Are you feeling a bit nervous now?
Yes.
Okay.
You're not going to test me on anything, are you?
No. Well, I might do, but also I think you'll have your mind changed during the next 9.5 minutes of radio, because we have a man who's going to convey just how exciting maths can be. He's possessed of a huge brain. The head of mathematics at the university where he works describes him as being perhaps the leading expert in solving challenging problems involving multiply connected geometries. Last month, Professor Darren Crowley published his solution to a formula which has remained incomplete for nearly 150 years. It is the Schwartz-Christoffel equation. Now, Darren is Professor of Applied Mathematics at Imperial College London, and he took the hop, skip and the jump from that campus to the studio here at Broadcasting House yesterday to tell us more about why maths is just terrific and what's in that blockbusting equation.
The Schwartz-Christoffel formula is one of these very valuable tools that scientists like to use, and they have been using for about 140 years. And what it does is very simple. It takes complicated shapes, and it's a way of making them simple.
In terms of a structure?
Yes, a structure.
I mean, you know, that door over there, this microphone over here.
Yes, let me give you an example. This is a nice example. Suppose you're tiling your bathroom floor. Now, of course, you go and buy tiles, and they're square or rectangular or something. But your bathroom's got nooks and crannies and curved bits of wall and things that are not very nice shapes. Not very easy to put down these rectangular tiles. So wouldn't it be lovely if you could just suddenly morph your bathroom into a rectangular bathroom? Then laying the tiles would be very easy. And then you morph it back to the original shape, now with the floor laid, so to speak. Well, that's what engineers do all the time. If they've got somewhere they're trying to solve a problem that's geometrically complicated, they morph it to something simpler using this Schwartz-Christoffel formula, and they're able to do their calculations there much more easily.
Why was it so hard to crack?
Well, what's happened, you see, is that the original Schwartz-Christoffel formula that's been used for many years doesn't allow you to have holes. I know it sounds very simple, but if you just have a hole in your bathroom floor, the Schwartz-Christoffel formula doesn't work. What I've done is enable you to account for any number of holes in your... So more complicated shapes.
Is it possible for you to explain to us exactly how you made the transition between what had already been found and the mathematical discovery you made that allowed a new formula to be used to bring holes in?
It sounds mundane, but mathematically having holes is a big problem. If you're just talking, you know, day to day, just having a hole in something is no big deal, but the mathematical description adds a whole new level of difficulty. And I had been, for many years before I was able to solve this problem, I'd been solving many other problems in physics where there were holes, and in solving those problems I'd accrued, if you like, the sort of understanding of these problems that enabled me to find something that eluded all these other people who'd looked for it in the past.
And did you literally have a eureka moment?
It was something of I suppose an epiphany, yeah. I think epiphany means you're kind of not really thinking about it, but it suddenly comes to you. And I wasn't really thinking about it, but I was in a somewhat tedious lecture in a conference in Paris, and sitting there, kind of half listening to the speaker, and scribbling on a piece of paper, looking like I was making notes, but actually doing these calculations to myself, and I guess because I was only half concentrating, it's the thing that I'd been looking for so long suddenly occurred to me.
And how did you know that you had cracked it?
Everything just fell into place. Because I'd spent so long thinking about this problem, when I had this one new idea in this lecture, everything suddenly slotted into place, and all of the problems that I'd had all resolved themselves at once.
So you didn't just immediately leap up, throw your papers in the air,
I was very excited.
Run from the hall?
No, I was very excited. I was so excited, I walked out of the lecture early. I left the room, and then I rushed back to my hotel, and I sat there for probably 4 or 5 hours, solidly. I think I got back there about 2 o'clock, and around 7, I was just starting getting hungry, but I spent all of that time scribbling and checking things, and it was then that I was really excited, because I knew that I checked sufficient things to know that I was onto something. Then I went out to get food, and I was just walking on air, you know, because I knew it was significant.
And what about the days and weeks that followed that? I mean, did you feel that you could tell anybody about the breakthrough? Is there a dreadful kind of, you know, I've got to get it out there before somebody else does it?
There is. That happened about a month later, and I called my postdoc, who works closely with me, and I sat down in a room with him, locked the door, and I went through it with him. And that was a very scary experience, because I knew that if anything was wrong, he'd notice it immediately. Mm. So that was scary, because if there was anything wrong, the whole thing could come crashing down, and I'd spent a month being very elated. But no, we went through it, and he corroborated everything, and that was that.
Was there a feeling, though, that somebody else out there might be onto exactly the same thing?
Yes, because I was inspired to work on this, because I saw another group working on it. So my approach was very different. But yes, there's always that sense of urgency. You need to get on with it in case somebody beats you to the post.
How would you have felt if somebody had?
Oh, terrible. It would be absolutely disastrous.
Is it right to think of this as being a holy grail of mathematics?
I'm not sure if this is a holy grail, but one of my mentors, a professor at Cambridge University, he was one of the first people to actually read through my paper when I'd written up all the details. And the next time I saw him, he said to me, "Darren, in the unlikely event that nobody ever uses this, it's a classic piece of mathematics." So it's something that the arbitrary applied mathematician can look at and say, oh, you know, that's an achievement.
You liken it to jazz music, don't you? Why?
I do, because I've always had a fascination with jazz. And what fascinated me about it is this idea of kind of spontaneous creativity over some theoretical framework. And research mathematics is very much the same. You kind of spend years at school learning what you need to know. And then once you've understood that, you can kind of improvise on it and be creative. And musicians, jazz musicians, you know, in live performances do the same thing. They understand chord progressions and what harmonies work well and things like that. And then they kind of improvise on them.
Is it a very exciting life being a mathematician?
Yeah, I enjoy it. I just get to spend my life thinking about what I think is important. I get to travel around the world and talk with bright people who are trying to do the same thing.
Do people ever expect you to be a bit of a performing maths puppy?
Well, only in pubs.
More no, on radio
when I go out, if I go out, I try to avoid telling anybody I'm a mathematician for a start, because I've noticed it can often have unexpected consequences. But the main thing I've noticed...
What's the unexpected consequence?
Well, some people are a bit scared. I remember I was at a wedding once, and I'd spent the whole afternoon sitting at the reception with, I think it was the parents of the bride, I can't remember, and we'd been bantering and having fun for 2 hours, and then they asked what I did. And I remember the mother just, she didn't say a word, and just got off and walked off, and then didn't speak to me for the rest of the day. I think she was, you know, there was some reaction there.
Why would people be scared of a maths brain? I mean, do you get the sense that people suddenly think you're too clever for them?
Something like that. I don't know. I like to think that I'm kind of a sociable person, and I think most of my colleagues are too. I think it's a vestige of what people's experience at school. I think a lot of people get very scared by math classes, for example.
Do you get frustrated with people who think that maths is a dry and dusty and dull subject?
I think it's a shame that that's the general perception of mathematics. I think that's, again, a vestige of how people are taught mathematics. It's robotic. You just do, you know, do exercise 1 to 30 and then hand it in. It can be very monotonous, but it's not how, you know... When I'm in a pub talking to somebody, I tell them I'm a mathematician, the first thing they think is that I just spend my life learning to add up more quickly. But it's nothing like that. It's a much more creative process about understanding things.
This may sound rude, and I don't mean it to at all, but do you have to be extremely clever to be very good at maths?
Not necessarily clever. I think you just have to have the right sensibilities.
What are they?
A very analytical mind. To break things down to the essence, which I do in all aspects of my life, much to the frustration of people around me, but it's a science of being precise about things and not being woolly. Because if you're woolly, you often don't make progress.
Is that the bit that perhaps people get confused about? They think that that means that you can't be creative, that precision and creativity
don't
match
mix
up.
I think so.
Does it matter to you that you can see all the effort and the detail that goes into coming to a mathematical conclusion, but very few people outside of quite a small world can ever really value or appreciate that?
Yeah, as with any kind of discipline that involves technique, be it in art or science, It's true that often the full glory of the details are only available to the cognoscenti, if you like, the people in the know, who really also understand those details. Nevertheless, I think the essence of these achievements, even if you can't see all the details, is still available to a much wider audience. I think it's the reason why a lot of, you know, popular science books sell really well. It's because there is a general curiosity to understand what mathematicians and scientists are doing.
Mm.
So while you can't always enjoy the glory of the detail, which for, as a mathematician, is the best part, the final overriding achievement can often be viewed more widely.
Can you add up very quickly?
I can actually, but that's because I have to grade exam papers every year. And so when you've graded 10 questions and you have to add up those 10 numbers 250 times, you do get quite good at it.
Professor Darren Crowley, the man who took on the Schwartz-Christoffel equation and won. And Nick, do you have those light bulb moments with ideas for your book?
Yes, I suppose so. It's one of the most exciting things about writing, I think, is before you've started writing. The writing bit's a bit dull, but thinking about what you're going to do can be really kind of creative and exciting. And I usually find that two things have to come together, two elements of a story, and then they start striking sparks off each other.
So the genesis for your latest book was seeing a teenage couple in North London, and is it right that you were kind of surprised to see the teenage dad still around, because the stereotype is of the single teenage mum?
I mean, I can remember looking at the girl and thinking, well, I kind of know your story because there's quite a lot about it in the media, but I don't know so much about the guy, so I started thinking about that. But a couple of other things had to come together, like the flash forward into the future parts of the story, and the skating, and then those three things together, I thought, oh, okay, that might be quite interesting to write about.
And then do you zoom from there, like Darren did? You know, he ran back to his hotel room and just had to scribble it all down before it had kind of left his brain.
No, because I can't hear the voice. All I've got is the bare bones of a story, and what I need to start writing properly is to hear somebody speaking. And because most of the books are first person, I actually do need to more or less hear a voice.
Mm. Does it help when other people suggest ideas? I know that a Swiss PR firm have been in touch with you recently with an idea you turned down. What was it they wanted you to do?
I turned it down. They asked me for a story for a book they were putting together that they said was going to shake the Swiss watchmaking industry.
And you couldn't think of anything?
Well, it just made me feel tired. I think if I were a younger man, I'd have loved to have shaken the Swiss watchmaking industry.
Oh, you can have that on your grave.
My days are gone now for that sort of thing.
Let's have Matt's final poem.
Sonnet, celebrating the elegance, ingenuity and creative cerebral power of Darren Crowdy's use of shot key groups to complete the Schwartz-Christoffel formula so that it works with irregular shapes and those with holes. You're clever, you. Far out. You're way out there, beyond the bozone layer where we reside. You plot the line fantastic in the air where ancient Greek and modern geek collide. You do jazz geometry. It can't be taught. Express yourself in dancing neuroglyphs. You place in brackets things that can't be thought, then multiply them by their absent widths. You're out there where the Holy Grail or chalice is, where mathematics like me can hardly breathe. Then, with applied complex analysis, you bring it down to earth just for a wheeze. You're far out. So far out, and so, so clever, that when you say Eureka, we say, whatever.
Darren will be delighted.
Oh, imagine being Darren right now. He'd be in tears.
Darren, will
you write
don't
cry. Saying how clever I am.
Oh, please, could you?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Within the next 3 minutes.
I'll start on the train. Yeah.
Now, there are certain pieces of music that are bound to come up more than once.